Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And this is a magical time of year because it is Shark Week.
Ah, best time of the year.
Yeah,
we've got our Shark Week lights up around the office.
Yeah, they look like little sharks.
Mm-hmm.
Mandatory consumption of gummy sharks.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's allowed to bring their lunch. It's just gummy sharks and tap water for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Really builds up your constitution.
Yep. And we tend to just go around in circles around each other
right.
in the break room.
Yep.
Which is fun. No, it is. It's an exciting time.
Yeah.
And
it's on in the lobby. We're not making that up.
No, we're not making that up at all. It actually premieres Sunday, July 31st on Discovery Channel for folks who are really excited about sharks. And so we thought that we would do a little homage to sharks this week and talk about how great they are.
Yeah.
And cool.
I mean, because the week itself was always pretty awesome growing up because you turn on Discovery and then they're just like nonstop shark attacks. Going
I was
going
to say mayhem and violence no matter where you look. And your parents can't say anything about it because they're
it's
sharks.
Educational. Yeah,
it's educational.
Yeah. And sharks truly are amazing creatures. But the one, you know, the one thing you don't think about as much are sharks in space.
No, because it just seems odd.
Yeah, or that NASA would at all care what a shark is up to or how a shark works. It just seems like these are totally different ends of the spectrum, you know?
But as we know, there are definitely parallels between the great blue ocean and the skies above us, right?
Right.
So to that point, we're going to talk about how sharks have informed NASA and also how they have informed other areas of our lives and why Michael Phelps needs to give a shark a big hug next time he sees one.
Well, for starters, there's not really any such thing as a space shark. There are, of course, no sharks flying around in outer space.
No.
But
dog, yes, but not a shark.
Yes. Yep. A mummified dog, right?
But, mm-hmm.
As for sharks, we have wondered for a long time whether or not the moon affects them, even though there are no sharks on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
People have always wondered, what does the lunar cycle affect the way sharks behave? Can we base their feeding preferences or their ferocity on what the moon is doing?
Yeah, that's true. And we know that a full moon signals breeding and migratory practices.
Mm-hmm.
And it also influences the tides because the tidal force is at its maximum. So you see a lot more intense feeding behavior at that time.
Right. And in tracking shark movement, scientists have observed large congregations of sharks during specific lunar cycles, as well as intensified feeding habits.
Mm-hmm. So we've got NASA definitely has its eye on sharks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is just one example, right? There are a lot of things that NASA has been doing with sharks because some of their technology actually is very helpful in tracking sharks.
And these are definitely more concrete than, well, maybe maybe the moon has some sort of influence on their activity. The one that really, first of all, as far as just tracking them goes, We do use satellites to track sharks.
Yeah.
Because some of these are either endangered species or they're just species we want to learn more about.
Mm-hmm.
So we have two kinds of tracking devices that we attach to the shark's fins. We have smart position only tags, also called spots, and we have pop-up satellite archival tags, or PATs.
Okay.
Spots attach to a shark's dorsal fins and upload location data to a satellite every time the animal surfaces. You know, so every time it comes up to eat a surfer or something, you know, or to attack Richard Dreyfuss, checks in. You know? PATs, however, record water temperature, water pressure, and light levels before detaching from the shark's fins at a set time. So this just sort of hangs out with the shark, shadows the shark, sees what the shark is up to and what kind of environments it's inhabiting, and then after a certain time detaches to go report back.
Yeah, so whether or not the shark knows it, it's in business with NASA
and
aggregating a bunch of data for them.
Yeah, the PAT device floats back to the surface after it's through, and then it transmits the data to the satellite.
Yeah. And then there's a second method, too, which I think is really cool. This is an algorithm.
Yes. Now, this is pretty fascinating because, all right, you look up at the night sky, and even if you're trained somewhat in astronomy and you can, you know, or even if you're, you can, you know, you can pick out every constellation and you can point to different star systems, you have to admit a really clear night sky can be really confusing because there's just so many stars and you're just, you know, trying to make sense of it all.
You cannot see them with the naked eye, all of them, right?
Yeah. So NASA, of course, has developed an algorithm to help to track this that can allow a computer to look at the sky and identify what's going on based on this, to the layman seemingly chaotic array of stars.
Yeah, and this was originally created by Edward J. Groth, and he was using this to try to map the intimidating star fields Hubble would uncover following its launch in 1990. Mm-hmm. So just so everybody understands the context there. But again, there's this correlation with stars and with sharks.
Yeah, because the whole deal is we're really interested in whale sharks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to know which one's which. What are they doing? This is a species that we would like to stick around for a while, and we would like to learn more about them. But how do you tell them apart, right?
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that the spots on their bodies, especially prominent on their heads, in their head region, they're all different. These are like the fingerprints of a whale shark.
Okay, so it's unique to each one.
Right. To the naked eye, it doesn't make any sense. It's just like, oh, well, there is another giant fish with spots on it, on its head. But we can actually use this same program, the same algorithm that's intended to make sense of the night sky, and it can make sense of the spots on a whale shark and actually identify individual whale sharks to the point where just random divers who encounter a whale shark can take a picture of it, and then they can send it in to the EcoOcean, which is ECOCEAN, EcoOcean.
Yeah.
Whale Shark Photo Identification Laboratory. And they're able to, through these user-submitted photos, keep tabs on, close to 2,000 whale sharks around the world.
Which is really cool because it's very much a public project as
well.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it also, the algorithm has been adapted to track the animals' North American populations as well.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, using the unique whisker markings on their muzzles.
Wow.
Yeah. Huh. So that's from NASA, actually. So it's really interesting that they are trying to learn about the stars, and they were able to use this to try to learn a little bit more about our own environment.
Right. And it's another great page from the whole book of space technology improving life or improving research on the planet itself.
Right.
Hand-me-down technology, but very useful.
This is another interesting NASA connection that was a surprise to me, but actually has to do with Julia Child.
Julia Child. The famed chef, TV, one of the first TV chefs.
6 foot two, just a wonderful, spirited woman who ushered the American palate into the 20th century.
The reason, really, that we have to suffer through all these more annoying TV chefs today on various reality shows, right?
Possibly, yes.
Except she was nice. She was not abrasive.
She was nice, and she brought us duck à l'orange.
Yeah.
And bœuf bourguignon. That was awful. But, you know, she has a lot of that she contributed to our society. But people, I think, are pretty familiar with the fact that she was a spy of sorts. And this is from NPR's The Lady Was a Spy. Julia Child worked for the OSS, which is a precursor to the CIA, and was assigned to solve a problem for the U.S. naval forces during World War II. Sharks would bump into explosives that were placed underwater, setting them off and warning the German U-boats that they were intended to sink. So they asked her to work on a recipe, as it were, of shark repellent. And together they all cooked up this shark repellent, and that was used to coat the explosives. So the shark repellent recipe was then later used to protect astronauts in space capsules that landed in shark-infested waters.
Yeah, because especially like the Apollo program and everything, they're returning to Earth in a capsule. Capsule is landing in the open ocean.
Yeah.
In many cases, and you would rather your highly trained astronauts not get eaten by a shark immediately.
No, not after all that training. That would be a big bummer.
And the Soviets were very interested in this as well. I read a 1970-something NASA report on the Soviet interest in shark repellent. And there was, there's a lot of interest and a lot of tests and a lot of sort of, oh, I don't know if it works, so maybe it works enough. And generally it was decided that it worked enough to use it, you know?
Yeah.
Like it was better than nothing.
I was going to say, there was no other alternative, so... No other alternates. So actually, sharks have taught us a lot, and definitely through biomimicry as well.
Yeah, not just lessons in how to avoid them and how to keep them from eating us.
Yeah.
But yeah, we can look at the shark and say, hey, that is an excellent design. What can we learn from this evolution home design.
Yeah, and it turns out that their skin is of particular interest, first because it's able to move through water really quickly, right? And second, because it keeps bacteria at a minimum.
Yeah, the skin itself consists of these tiny tooth-like scales that prevent small eddies and vortices from forming, which can slow you down. So so Speedo was instantly interested in this.
Yeah, yeah. And this is so cool because what they discovered is that the friction is different over different parts of the shark's body. So the skin on the shark, the texture changes to better manage the flow of water.
Huh.
Yeah. And Speedo, of course, was like, oh, hey, we could apply this. We could make some money off of this.
Yeah, and it was actually when this first made the rounds in the news, there were some people that were like, is this really fair that people can wear it? Because it was, you know, shaving some considerable time if you were wearing like a full shark skin bodysuit. Where I think at the actual name that the Speedo product is Fast Skin, one word.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I can kind of get some of that argument, you know? It's like, if they're improving their performance purely through this awesome outfit, I mean, maybe I'm just putting this out there. Maybe all competitive swimming should be done naked, because then it's more, you know, Greek Olympic style.
Yeah,
you know?
Greek Olympic style. Okay, so I mean, I would definitely think that viewership would go up.
Yeah,
yeah. It's a possibility. I don't know.
Maybe if they, you know, to get around the TV censors, maybe if they just dyed the water like a real murky color, and then it would be, you know, instantly, you know, covering any potential nudity that would show up, right?
You know, just to ratchet up the fun factor, they could put sharks in the water while the naked swimmers
swam.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, I mean, they really, the suit, I think, made a big difference. It's a 3% improvement in swimming speed due to the original shark skin suit, which likely contributed to the fact that 80% of the swimming medals won in the 2000 Olympics were won by athletes wearing Speedo's Fast Skin suits. And then also, some of the swimmers broke 13 of 15 world records.
Wow.
And when you're talking about a tenth of a second here, I mean, that's a huge difference in this sport. So Speedo has made further modifications to their Fast Skin suit based on continued research, and it now has something like a 4% reduction in friction.
Wow. And the sharks, of course, get no credit. Yeah.
None.
Yeah.
Yeah. Poor guys.
We've also used the shark skin technology for other things. We've been able to use this technology to create fast traveling ship hulls that also deter the attachment of underwater organisms,
yep.
You know, like barnacles and whatnot. And Australia's BioPower Systems has been working on a really cool shark inspired innovation. The company hopes to anchor mechanical fins based on, you know, the shark's body, in the middle of sea currents in order to generate hydroelectric power. So it's kind of like a windmill, except
in the ocean.
Yeah, in the ocean. And it looks like a giant, whale, giant shark fin.
That is going to scare the pants off of someone who's just in a boat having a nice leisurely day on the ocean.
Or scare the Fast Skin bodysuit off of someone who happens to.
Going for the naked thing here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, chew on that.
Yeah. We'll just leave on the naked note.
Yeah. Chew on that while we do a quick break. And we'll be back right after that.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
And we're back.
All right. I know you got some email there.
Yeah, it's time for a little listener mail. We actually have quite a bit. The other podcast we recorded this week was the electronic music one, which went a little long, so I didn't get to read some of the wonderful comments and emails that we've received from everyone. But I have a handful here. First, let's hear from Jay from Arkansas. Jay writes in, "Hi, Robert and Julie, longtime listener and huge fan of your podcast and blog. I appreciate you covering the method of Loki. This, of course, was discussed in our Memory Palace episode. I have found it unusually helpful and extremely entertaining. I can definitely identify with Julie's comment on how the very premise of how this method works causes her to conjure up dreamlike situations, which, of course, make them more memorable. I am a very visual person and have adopted this memory approach almost daily. Since listening to your podcast, I have used it to memorize the original 13 colonies, numerous shopping lists, and also to wow friends by memorizing lists of 20-plus random words in a very short period of time. Most recently, I have used this method to memorize all of the U.S. presidents in order. There were definitely some colorful images generated to memorize that list. And he gives the example of puke cannon for Buchanan and a tea glass that continually refills itself for Fillmore.
Very clever.
Thanks again and keep up the great work. Well, that was awesome to hear somebody take the Method of Loki, the Memory Palace, and start ramming it into their life on a daily basis.
Yeah, I'm still using it myself.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what did you use it for last?
Some appointments that I needed to make.
Cool. Here is another listener email, and this is from Molly. Molly writes in and says, "Hey guys, just finished listening to your space religion podcast. Interesting. My immediate thoughts when you mentioned Designing a Religion, Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein. Granted, this is kind of the opposite of what you mentioned. In this case, a Martian, who is really a human but raised as a Martian by Martians, comes to Earth and designs a religion here. Excellent book if you haven't read it. Interesting, thought-provoking ideas about the nature and need of religion and the nature of humans. At any rate, I dig the podcast. Love the mentions of my favorite books, music, movies. For instance, a shout-out to Dune in this one." And then she also mentions Robert Anton Wilson as being particularly interesting. Along these lines. I have actually not read Stranger in a Strange Land. It's definitely on the list. But
your summer reading list?
Maybe. I don't know. My reading list is out of control.
Yeah, I've seen that stack of books on your desk.
But I was really really pleased with some of the feedback we got on this, because we didn't get any like crazy grumpy feedback from, I think, anyone. Like, everybody that had something to say, it was, you know, all along the lines of, oh, I think you know, space and religion means this, I think it means that. And several people wrote in with examples of space religions from science fiction. I think somebody on Twitter mentioned the religion that shows up in the Warhammer 40,000 universe, which is a gaming, tabletop gaming kind of universe, but there's definitely a lot of ideas that are brought together in that regarding what a science fiction interplanetary species religion would consist of.
Yeah.
So it was a pleasure to hear all that.
Yeah, and I think that we are fortunate to have such a thoughtful audience with a lot of moxie, I might add. Moxie mind blowers out there.
I'm going to read just one quick one here before we close. And this is from James responding to our Funny or Die podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Which we also we receive a lot of cool stuff.
We'll cover this later.
Yeah, we'll cover later. But he just wanted to throw in some quick funny words. And he said, supple, pork loin.
Oh, I love that one.
And toot. So he also said that anything with loin in it is going to be pretty funny.
Yeah.
Like tenderloin, loincloth. And yeah, it's a
and
funny
pork
word.
Chop.
Pork chop.
Yeah. And applesauce. All right.
So there you have it. If you have anything you would like to add, anything you would like to share with us, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook. We are Blow the Mind on both of those feeds.
And you can also drop us a line at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow.